My name's Ed Addio. I live at 123 Alta Vista, and I'm interviewing Dick Spotswood, who lives at 200 McGee here in Mill Valley. Dick, give me your full name and today's date.
Richard D. Spotswood, January 7th, 2015.
What's the D stand for?
David.
Okay, and how old are you? When were you born? Let's put it that way.
I was born on March 25th, 1947. That makes me 67.
67. And let's go as far back in your ancestry as we can. How far back do you go?
My family in the United States comes from Virginia, and the Virginians are great genealogists. And so they've traced it back somewhere into the 1300 or 1400s in lowland Scotland. I know we have a relative buried at Westminster Abbey because I was at the plaque, who was the Episcopal Bishop of Edinburgh, which means he was part of the English invading army. And the first sponsor came to the United States in, I believe, 1705. That was Alexander Spotswood, who my son is named after, my grandfather is named after, and he came the right way. When he got off the boat, hit the ground, he was the governor of Virginia. British, technically the lieutenant governor, the governor is never shows up. The governor, colonial governor is the lieutenant governor. There is no governor.
That's in the mid-1700s.
No, that was 1705.
1705.
And so he was the colonial governor. He was a kind of autocratic guy. A group of his discovered the Shenandoah Valley, though I think they're pretty certainly it was out there. He founded, I guess, Spotsylvania County, Virginia, which is a Virginia county. Had an iron works in Spotsylvania, and built the governor's palace in Williamsburg, which is kind of a famous building. He had been a general in the British Army. I think he was at the Battle of Blenheim, and the reward was, he was well connected with the ward, was governor of Virginia. After he was basically, they changed the governors, removed, he was there for a long time. He stayed in Virginia, had the iron works, and I believe in the colonial era, I'm pretty certain this is true. He was the assistant postmaster general of the colonies under the postmaster general, who was Benjamin Franklin. In Virginia, they're all interrelated, all these kind of first families of the Piedmont region, so we're distantly related to Martha Washington, not George, the Lees. They're all these families, though. It's just,
it's Robert E. Lee.
Yeah, but there's really 100 families like that, and so the marrying options were kind of limited, and so they were the what they call Tidewater Virginia people.
And so after him was
there was John Spotswood, who was a major at Valley Forge in the Revolutionary Army, though I think he was more aligned with General Horatio Gates than Washington. They were on the right side of the Revolution, and they fought in the Revolutionary War. Petersburg was where they lived in Virginia. They weren't Episcopalians, they were Presbyterians or something like that. Kind of upper class, upper middle class. Eventually, they became typical people like that. They kind of didn't keep the money. They all went to college, though. And my last Virginia relative was Martha or Maddie Spotswood. I met her, stayed with her a couple of days. Actually, in a hotel, but stayed. She had an old house there. She was an elderly lady. Saw her a couple of times. And she was the last Spotswood of my line in Virginia. There's a whole lot of, there's other Spotswoods out there. There's black Spotswoods out there.
Oh, really?
They had probably worked for the
slaves.
The slaves. We're also relative to it, and I belong to something called the Friends of Peter Francisco. Peter Francisco is a relative of mine, and he was quite a character, very well known. There's once again a whole society about him, and he was during the Revolutionary War a privateer, a pirate, commissioned by the United States government, though. He was an American privateer to raid British ships.
Ah.
And Alexander's sponsor actually was involved was the capture of Bluebeard, because I was on the Outer Banks, North Carolina, and there was a monument to the group that Governor sponsored led to capture the pirates. So there was a lot of rough stuff out there in those days. Anyway, that's the Virginia side of the family. Period. It's always been spelled this way since they came to the United States. There's three branches of the family, apparently, that came to the U.S., Albany, Virginia, and Key West. And I was in Key West one time. The sheriff was a very well-known, a pastime sheriff, but a very well-known figure was a Spotswood. And I walked down the street, and there's a law firm of Spotswood, Spotswood, and Spotswood.
Hmm.
And I wrote to the guy. He was very nice. He wrote back and said they were, you know, how they came up.
Distant relatives?
Very distant. You know, the Petersburg were the Virginia ones were the real relatives.
Yeah. So now what about, let's come all the way up to your grandfather and father.
My grandfather on my father's side, who I never met, was a, passed the bar, didn't like it, went back to school. He went to Hampton, Sydney, and then he went back to law school, and he became a lawyer. No, excuse me, started as a lawyer from Hampton, Sydney, became a mining engineer.
Mining engineer?
Mining engineer in the West. That's why he came to the West. Married a woman from California, from an old Spanish family, a Mala. I just got a letter from the Mala, one of the Malas, tracing it all back.
Where did he live?
San Luis Obispo, an old line, pre-statehood, Mexican side of the family. That's where the Catholics come in, on that uh-huh. side of the family. But they were from San Luis Obispo County, and there's still, Mala Point is down there, and the county clerk used to be a Mala, and it was a big family. And they were related to the Carrillos, who were another early California family.
How would you spell that?
Carrillo. Like the Cisco kid was
Leo Carrillo.
Leo Carrillo was part of that family.
Yeah.
And so that's that side. They came to California. My grandmother and grandfather met, presumably in San Francisco, got married, had two kids in San Francisco, my father and his sister, who passed away when she was 50.
Your father's name was?
Robert Spotswood. He was a San Francisco policeman, police lieutenant, previously been in the Navy twice. Enlisted man, was in the Merchant Marine before the war, liked the Merchant Marine, liked going to sea. And after the war, because he was a child of depression, saw a good civil service job. That's how I think he approached the police department and didn't want to be in an office. And so spent his whole career as a policeman. He liked being in the police department.
And his sister?
Virginia, I knew her pretty well. I knew her very well. She died of open heart surgery. She had rheumatic fever as a child.
Oh.
Died young. She worked for the Military Air Sea MSTS Transport Service at Fort Mason.
Oh. Wow.
As a civilian employee, but spent most of her life working for MSTS.
Yeah. So now back to your mother's side of the family.
Well, that's the typical Italian peasants coming from two places, both of which oddly spoke the same dialect.
Her name was?
My mother's name is Angelina Mary Centenaro, Spotswood, Centenaro.
Centenaro.
Centenaro as in centuries. They all tended to live a long time, for a century, which was true, except for my mother, who was a smoker. But my grandfather lived to be in his 90s. My grandmother lived to be in her 90s. He was from Rapallo on the coast. They spoke Genovese. They were Genovese.
Oh.
Liguria, in other words to describe that part of the coast.
That's where Columbus was born.
Columbus was born there. My mother, grandmother, actually was from the area inland, a city called Piacenza on the Po. It's about 30 miles, 40 miles southeast of Milan. It's where Giorgio Armani is from. It's a high-tech center now of medical technology. I still have a cousin who's a priest there. I was just sent a YouTube video of him. He was a Monsignor at the local cathedral. Mm. They spoke Genovese. They both did. They came to San Francisco. My grandmother was born in San Francisco, went back when she was like 5, because a lot of Italians didn't work out. They went back. She came back when she was 15 again. In between was the earthquake. She had to have the midwife swore that she was born here, because the Hall of Records was, you know, burned down. My grandfather came here in 1902, when he was, I believe, 17, he came because in Italy, the older son got everything. You know, and the other ones either worked for the older son or went in the military. Didn't work out. So they all had an option. Go to America. It worked out. And so all the brothers went to America except for the older brother. Hmm. And they all moved to the Bay Area and got jobs. My grandfather was sitting at the waiting for a streetcar at the corner of Noe and Market Street on an April day in 1906 when the earth shook.
Oh.
The story is he goes to work because they get the jobs they get are relatives, so his uncle hires him. They come, everybody's, it's all, you know how it works, and the uncle hires him work in the restaurant. So he's waiting for the streetcar for the breakfast trade in the morning. You know, takes it, and the streetcar comes after the earthquake, still comes, probably a cable car, and he gets to the restaurant, and you know it's chaos. But the fire, you know, the old timer said the fire was a bad thing, and by the next day the fire was approaching the restaurant. And the uncle told my grandfather and his friend, there's a big cigar case. He has big glasses cases in the front where you buy cigars from. He says, this place is going up in flames. Boys, it's worth a lot of money. Take it. It's yours. So they get a horse and wagon, get all the cigars, all the stuff, load it in the wagon, take it to where they think is a safe place. He said, what happened? Well, the restaurant burnt down. Then what happened? Day later, the place where we bought the cigars burnt down. Fire just followed it. You know, they'd get fired up ahead. He got a job immediately working to rebuild San Francisco. They worked on streetcar lines. A lot of Italians were in the produce business. He worked in the produce market. And then, like a lot of Genovese, they got into the scavengers, garbage collections, which was a co-op. Nobody could own more than one share. If you owned one share, if you were a share, you were a partner. Hmm. A lot of guys were partners. You had to be a Genovese to be in that. I mean, no Lucchese's, that kind of stuff, you know.
Yeah.
Most of the people who were scavengers were pretty practical. They were all with their Genoveses, you know, the slam on Genoveses, the Italian frugal people, shall we say. And their rule was that you worked hard, didn't spend your money, put what you earned in the Bank of America, bought a piece of property, paid off the property, and then repeat. If you do that in the city and county of San Francisco starting about 1920, you're making a good decision. And that's what they all did. And they didn't believe in selling. So my grandfather, he wasn't by any means, he wasn't a rich guy, he was a garbage man. But he owned a flat in the marina, had an apartment house, place in Sonoma. My cousin, they had a 24-unit apartment house in Pacific Heights.
Wow.
Yeah. So that was typical.
Yeah. So your mother and father inherited all that?
Well, he had sold the apartment house. Fundamentally, I inherited it. Because I was old enough to write the papers. It always would go through the mother's side. So my parents lived at the house. Life estate, basically.
And
I inherited it. And I actually, some years ago, traded it away for commercial building.
Wow.
In Arizona.
How did your mother and father meet?
At a YLI dance.
YLI?
You know what the YLI is? There's the YMI and the YLI. The YMI is Young Men's Institute, and the YLI is Young Ladies Institute. And they had a building on Oak Street. And the YMI and YLI were Catholic youth organizations. And it was well known that this was a place to meet similar people. So they had dances and excursions and all that kind of stuff. And so he met her at a YLI dance. And she, of course, there she's from Marina. You know, our house is the Marina District, so she's there with all her Marina District friends. It's all with the same group.
Yeah.
And they got married in 1937 at St. Vincent de Paul Church in San Francisco. The first... my mother said she liked him because he was exotic. He had been in the Merchant Marine. So he'd been out of California.
Oh.
He used to sail back and forth on the Orleans to Honolulu. He was a waiter. And then he worked did the round the world trip. Well, in those days, just to go to Honolulu was a big deal. Around the world.
Yeah.
Holy moly. And the first date he took her to was to show he's a big shot. Was to the St. Francis Drake Hotel to hear the big bands in those days. So the band was, the name will ring a bell to you, Harry Owens and the Royal Hawaiians.
Oh, yeah.
And
now, wait, there's a Francis There's a Drake Hotel.
Sir Francis. And a St. Francis. This is the St. Francis.
St. Francis. St. Francis Hotel.
You know, on Union Square.
Yeah.
So I would, you know, big time band in all those days. In the 30s. Yeah. They got married. He was working at, I think, might have been when he was working at U.S. Steel down South City.
U.S. Steel?
Yeah, United States Steel Corporation.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Remember that? He worked there for a while. And they didn't think they could have kids. The doctor said you can't have kids.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. And so what happens next to him is he's going up to Funston Playground to play tennis on a Sunday. He comes home to my mother and says, is this a big deal? Apparently the Japanese attacked a place called Pearl Harbor. Well, he knew Pearl Harbor because he'd been to Honolulu 15 times, 20 yeah. times. It's a big deal. And he enlisted the Navy and right away. And because I've said, oh, a lot of guys did that in those days. It was just a.
Yeah.
And he went to sea. He was on a destroyer and he was a storekeeper. And on transport ships, mostly on destroyers, all in the South Pacific, which he liked. You know, I mean, they're you know, the real stuff, but
yeah.
It's a big war and a big Navy. After war, he came home, which, of course, made my mother happy and his dog happy, Julius, who's just hysterical, apparently. And then one day she doesn't feel well, and she goes to the doctor and says, what's up? And he says, well, we make mistakes. You're pregnant.
Right.
And so that was a couple of years after they got back. But it was a classic baby boom situation. You know?
And so was that you, the first baby?
The only one, yeah.
Well, you have a sister, don't you?
No.
Oh, your father had a sister.
My father's sister. I'm an only child.
So you're a post-war baby?
Yeah, 47.
Living in what neighborhood?
The Marina, in a building owned by my grandparents. And by this time, they lived in Sonoma.
Oh.
They bought a place before the war. My grandfather retired early. And so he bought a place up in Boy Springs and had his garden up there. And for most of my life until I was 15, there was two sisters. My mother had a sister. Every other weekend, we'd go to Sonoma. The other weekend, she and her family go to Sonoma. And it was typical Italians. They're very close. On Sundays, people come over, and the food was fabulous.
Yeah.
And I go along very well with my grandparents, who I knew very well. I never met him, my father's father. My mother's mother, I met, but she died like in 55. She lived on Carl Street, you know, by Keysar Stadium. Mm-hmm.
So what schools did you go to?
Went St. Vincent de Paul, kindergarten, grammar school. And then I took the hardest test I'd ever had to worry about, including the bar exam. Could I get into SI? And all my friends had applied. And I can remember like it was yesterday, the day, it's a Saturday. And I knew that the letters were out. And I opened the letters. And it was a big, big, thick envelope, which is a good sign. And it said I got in. And I said to myself, you know, it's going to work on out for here on out.
Huh, really?
I did. I said at the time, come to SI. If you get to SI, you're going to get into college. If you get into college, you're going to get a job. It's just going to work. And I never really worried about a test as much as I worried about that test.
Wow.
And I think that was right.
Wow. So after SI?
I wanted to be an architect.
Uh-huh.
I like to draw. I always had a drawing board in my room. My parents encouraged it. But I could only draw buildings. I couldn't draw people. Well, it's not like an architect. I was told as a kid, oh, you're going to be an architect someday. So when you do that, you apply to architecture school. And I got in. Once again, at Cal Poly, San Luis Obispo. My father loved that because he loved San Luis Obispo. And Cal Poly was a good school, you know. And it turned out I wasn't really meant to be an architect. It was just, it's not just drawing. You know, the building has to stay up.
That's right.
And that's math, it's strength in materials, and it really was very difficult. It made law school look like nothing. Maybe I wasn't suited for it. And anyway, I got out of it.
How far did you go?
No, I didn't go. I was 4 months. Oh. And I remember the day came in where, this was a good thing, this is a good story. There was an announcement in the Cal Poly Daily Bulletin they used to post up. Today's the last day to withdraw, drop, or transfer without penalty. And I said to this, I read it to my roommate, and he read it and then shot out of the room, Fremont Hall. And he comes back and I said, what's that about? He says, I had to get out. This is horrible. I hate this. And I didn't know I could do it. That's the last day. I said, you got out like that? Yeah. And I called my parents and said, I want to get out. And they said, do whatever you think's right.
Oh, good for them.
And I went to the Dean Haslam, a famous guy, and told him, he said, that's fine, I'll sign the papers. But before I do, let me urge you to think about one thing first. If you want to get out of architecture, there's a new field called city planning. We have a major in that. You might want to be a city planner. Kind of think about it. I mean, you know, you got to decide today, but, you know, it's something you could just segue into. It kind of sounds like something that fits your interest. And I said, thanks, but I want out. And I went over to what they call the social science department, which is political science. They were happy to take me. And that was that. And I had a girlfriend down there.
Go ahead. Yeah.
So that kept me down there for an extra year.
Oh. So you switched from architecture to political science?
Yeah. At Cal Poly.
Yeah.
And I had been a little involved in politics anyway. When I was at SI, good story. They've got all these great stories. When I was at SI, Father Tom Reed was the principal. And you didn't go to a Jesuit high school, did you?
No.
It's a fairly strict operation. But it's a mutual thing. Everybody, you know, everybody got it. They were happy to be there. Nobody ever left in their life SI voluntarily. They might have asked you to leave. Something else might have happened. But you never wanted to leave. Anyway, one day he announces we're going to have a speaker in the gym. Speaker's going to be a USF grad, which, as far as he was concerned, that set that up, named Pierre Salinger in the gym. And that's fine. I called together. Salinger was running for the United States Senate. And it was the primary. And he spoke. And Reed said, you can't do this everywhere. You can't in a Jesuit school. You can't do it in a Catholic school. Any Catholic school, but a Jesuit school particularly, because they're not, you don't have to answer anybody but their own guys. Everybody is going to be involved in this campaign, in this election, he said. You're going to learn how the political system works, the whole school. Now, there's two Democrats running and there's two Republican runs. I don't care who you volunteer for. You will volunteer for one of them. Well, that was pretty clear.
Yeah.
And they were. They were not jesting when they say these things, which I thought was a great idea. So Salinger seemed okay to me, so I volunteered for Salinger. Cranston was running. Max Rafferty was running. It was Max Rafferty then. It was Kuchel. I can't remember the Republicans, but there were two Republicans. And so when I volunteer, they say a man's going to come out and bring you your walking kit to walk the precinct. The doorbell rings. Who's the volunteer to bring me the walking kit? Father Tom Reed.
Oh, really?
He was for Salinger. He's not doing the stuff. Reed, San Francisco is different today. After I graduated in the early 70s, Reed kind of retired. Not completely. He's still a Jesuit, but he's not the principal anymore. He runs for the San Francisco Board of Education as a priest. Father Tom Reed, S.J., running for Board of Education. He wins.
Wow. There you go.
There you go. From there I went to Cal Poly. Decided Cal Poly. I got a 4.0 average, one quarter of Cal Poly. I am not a 4.0 student. There's something wrong here. It's ridiculous. And so I said, I want to go to law school. I figured I was probably going to go with USF. I had a lot of friends at USF. I transferred to USF. And I spent the last 2 years at USF to get my degree in political science, but doing two other things which were very formative to me. One, I was very active in the Young Democrats at Cal Poly, and I was very active. I was president of Young Democrats at USF. And I was very active with the school radio station, which was a big deal at the time, KUSF, which is an activity, really. I had a show and did all sorts of stuff. So those were multiple social groups. And I was interested in politics. And San Francisco's a good place to do it. So the way I did it was invited speakers to come to USF and got to know them. George Moscone, Leo McCarthy, you name it, we invited them. And they usually came. We even invited, which was a tremendous opportunity in college, we invited Bobby Kennedy to come in 1968. And he came. And April of 68. And it was an incredible experience.
Yeah.
And I was, he was controversial at the time. That was April of 68. Yes, he was kind of controversial because he'd run against McCarthy among the Libs.
Wasn't 68 the year he was killed?
Yeah. Yeah. So there was very little security. We had a couple of cops block off Golden Gate Avenue, which was a mob of people. And he had his own personal security, Rafer Johnson.
Oh, yeah.
But there was no real security. He was killed. I remember I was with him. We were shot. I was at a Kennedy headquarters at the old California Hall on Larkin Street when I was watching the television. Most people, they would run the credits. They thought the election night was over. In the fall, we had, we were on a roll. Ed Muskie was a vice presidential nominee with Humphrey, running against Nixon. And we invited Muskie to come to USF. We argued it was a Catholic school, urban area kind of thing. It might be good. Well, he came. And I was asked to introduce him because I was the president of the Democrats. And I said, me, why, you're the guy, want a student, you'll be good, you'll like it. Oh, great, I'll do it. And the way they arranged it was, I would meet Muskie at the Fairmont Hotel, ride in the car to him, to USF, to brief him. We didn't have a reception, really, for the faculty. So they wanted me on this. And then he'd go out and speak, and I'd introduce him at the speaking engagement, and he'd leave. The place was Pat Madhouse. And it was a tremendous experience. I went to the Fairmont Hotel, and next thing I know, I'm sitting alone in the lobby. The room's empty. By this time, the security is tight because Kennedy's been assassinated. And Muskie and the security team sweeps out. A guy motions to me, Senator. I get in the car, and we drive down California Street. All California Street is closed off. Mm. Cops, they're doing the thing like that. Well, for a guy who's 20 years old, 21 years old, riding down the limo with the vice presidential nominee briefing him with the street closed and the sirens and all this shit, it didn't get better than that.
Yeah.
In fact, I'm not sure it ever got better than that. And we pull up at USF and there's thousands of people getting out. And I remember getting out of the car and all the cameras are going off. Oh, this is great. I love this shit. That kind of sucks you into this stuff. And it was just a great experience. It was a great opportunity.
Great.
I was just very lucky. I was at the right place at the right time.
Right.
And I kind of made the opportunity, but you had to be at the right place at the right time. Anyway,
so by this time you're interested in politics.
Yeah.
But you're also going to law school, right?
No, this was undergraduate.
Oh, this is USF undergraduate.
Yeah.
Okay.
Then I took a break for a year to go in the Army because I was going to get drafted. But I didn't. So I joined the Fighting 91st Division at Fort Cronkite, California.
What year was that?
That was 1969. I graduated in 69, took a year off. I was fortunate. I didn't have a job, but middle of that year, since I was now already getting involved in politics and knowing people, I was invited to be a staffer for a member of the Board of Supervisors campaign, a woman named Dorothy von Berlingen, who was an incumbent supervisor and who was challenged, heavily challenged. And so I worked for Dorothy and doing the rounds and doing all that stuff with her, meeting a lot of people. And she managed to pull it out. And just before the election, I get a phone call from my mother. I'm at the Salish Union of the Pacific or someplace like that down on Fremont Street. And somebody said, your mother's trying to reach you. Okay, get home. What is it? She says, there's a letter here. It's from the Army. Should I open it? Yeah. You got to be at Fort Knox, Kentucky on this day, right after the election. And I said, oh, shit. Oh, I guess I got to do it. Okay. I knew it was coming. I just didn't know when. And I walked out, and the first guy I saw was Bert Feinstein, Diane's late husband, Dr. Bert Feinstein. He says, Spots, you don't look too good. I said, I just got told I'm going to go in the Army. Vietnam's roaring. He said, oh, my God. You know, mm-hmm. I said, that's the reserves. But and so after the election, Dorothy won, and I went to Fort Knox. Served 6 months at Fort Knox, which is, basic training at AIT. And, spent 6 years in the reserves. Fort Cronkite, Fort Ord. Came back. That was out of the way. Started law school at USF. Played politics at the same time. I think I'd been elected to the Democratic Central Committee somewhere along, appointed to it. Oh, I had a summer job. Summer job was, once again, I started to meet people. You know, I was out there. So they said, do you want to work for the Central Committee as their voter registration guy, run the voter registration drive? Sure, it's a paid job. And after that, they said, you want to be on the Central Committee? It wasn't a big deal in those days. Sure, I'll do it. You know, and I ran it, got reelected, you know. So I did that for a few years. Got out of law school.
Okay.
Here's my whole life's history.
Okay, so now you're back from the Army, you go to law school.
Got out of law school. Need to pass the bar. Good advice from George Moscone. I was having dinner with him because we were volunteering and helping. And he says, bar exam. He says, do this. He says, take the bar exam review course. We had a group. The night before the exam, set yourself a goal, 6 o'clock, whatever. Stop. Have a good dinner. Don't have much to drink. Go to bed early. Don't ever study again. Don't cram through the night. Relax. Do it. Come home. Repeat. Relax. You have to look something up. Keep it to 15 or 20 minutes. Just be relaxed. Otherwise, you'd be just too much pressure and you can snap. It was good advice. I passed. Mm-hmm. Needed a job. Thought I had a job plan from a promise from a politician. Did not work out. Which is a long story, but it didn't work out in the city attorney's office. So I said, I got to find a job. The only thing didn't want to do was look for a job. So I go to the phone book. Most people start with A. Some people start with Z. I opened the book in the middle and started with J. Who starts with J? And so I wrote 10 letters, 10 resumes, did them individually in those days. And within 3 or 4 days, I got a couple of calls. One from a guy wasn't much of an offer, and the other one was from a guy named Milt Jacobs, who said, come on down and I'll interview. And it didn't pay a lot, but it was phrased that if I did certain kind of stuff, I got bonuses. Which was actually a very, now in retrospect, extremely generous formula, because it worked out very well. I took the job from Milt Jacobs. Right. I'd only been looking for a week, and I didn't want to look. And he was a nice guy. And
how old were you now?
27. Oh. And right after after I passed the bar, I studied for the bar in 73, and I got married in 73. So when I got married, I was not a member of the bar. I had graduated from law school. Right, the election took place. We get married the 10th. And we go to Europe on our honeymoon.
Okay, this is a good place to talk about Joanne then.
Yes.
Joanne Peterson?
Joanne Peterson. She's introduced to me on a New Year's Eve date by friends of ours, Dory and Greg Reichen. We had just went away with them last weekend. And she's living on Clay Street. And, you know, I mean, that was New Year's Eve, new day, January 1, 1973, and we were engaged like 4 months later, 4 or 5 months later, and planned to get married in November 10th, and that's what we did. I worked for Dorothy von Veridlin through Election Day, which was like the 2nd or 3rd, get married on the 10th, and a couple of days later we go on our honeymoon, which is to see my relatives in Italy, and go to other places, England, France, and we're in Paris in a little hotel, a family hotel, bathroom down the hall. And so Sunday morning I get up to go to the bathroom, and there's 2 telegrams on the door. The first one I open is for my friend Tom Gilley, which says, congratulations, counselor. The second one's my parents saying, you passed the bar exam. And we said, we went to Notre Dame for Mass that Sunday. And I says, now we can use the credit card. Because I thought I'd have a job. I get back to another job had failed. So that's when I look for the politician let me down. That's when I looked for the job in government with Jacobs. And I have been associated with him for 42 years.
So your first job was my last. 42 years.
Yeah, good lead.
Yeah, you became a partner.
Yeah. Where's a small operation? You know, if it's me and Milt, his father-in-law had worked with him before, and he'd retired. And then we had another guy work with us. Then we moved, and we grew, and we had other people work for us. And mm-hmm. You know, Greg Reichen joined us, and Rich Winnie and Don, and we just had a big operation. By our standards, a big operation.
Yeah. Are you living in San Francisco?
Until 1976. When I was in the Army, a couple of us discovered that the Army rules required the Army to let us off on Sunday morning if we wanted to go to church, because they didn't have a church on post. It's in the regs. And so we said, great. So we actually went to church, but then went to breakfast. We certainly made it a bigger deal than, you know, stuff. And the Army went along. And so often we went to church in Mill Valley because we were at Fort Crockett. And so we drive around after, get our coffee and donuts, look at this town. You know, we're San Franciscans, but it was pretty exotic for a San Francisco guy. And did the same with Sausalito. And so I looked pretty good. And so Joanne and I decided we wanted to buy a house. We've been married a couple of years. We wanted to buy a house. And we checked out Mill Valley, and she liked it. And so we finally decided, had enough money to kind of just buy a place in those days. And we had between two places. Place on Magellan Avenue in San Francisco, which would have been a pretty good buy too, and at this place in Mill Valley. And we decided Mill Valley, let's try something different. And the first house we looked at, it was too expensive. And we made a bid, but fell through, and it was crazily expensive. It was $110,000. Mm. It's now God knows what it's worth. It's on Coronet. And so the place we got came up, and we either got it for 88 or 92.
What was that address?
200 McGee.
Oh, 200 McGee is the first house in Bell Valley?
Yeah, well, first one we bought, the only one we ever bought.
And the one you live in now?
Yeah.
Wow.
So I moved in there, got it, and got it in 76. And Alex, Beth came along in 78.
Okay, your son Alex?
Came in 83.
And Beth?
Was born in 78. And in, I had, the first thing, I had been involved in San Francisco politics. And I had been on some minor things. I was on the Central Committee, was very active. And I kind of looked like I'd be getting involved in San Francisco politics. And when I moved, I said, that's the end of that.
Right.
I don't know. I know five people in Mill Valley, one of which was Kathleen Foote and Don Rubenstein. And, you know, I immediately joined the neighborhood association because I'm a joiner, and I'm in the association for a year, and the president takes a leave, and there's nobody else who wants to be the president, so I'm the president for a year, and I start to meet people. I knew Foote and Rubenstein. They introduced me to people. You know, hard to believe. I moved to 76 in a time when it was really much more fixed here, and in 80 I was elected.
To the city council?
Yeah.
Yeah, now we come to... This is when you and I first met.
Yeah.
I worked on your campaign.
Yeah.
So that was 1980, first elected to
April.
The city council.
Yeah. I knew John Jager, who was running too. I had been introduced to him, and he and our kids had gone to the zoo a couple of times together, things like that. I knew him real well, but he encouraged me to run.
Right.
He had encouraged me.
Now, you were the last person to serve more than two terms in Mill Valley.
Right? I was.
Three terms.
I think it was three terms. 1970. I had, when I was a city councilman, I had, after 2 years, long Mill Valley story, I was elected as a director to the Golden Gate Bridge. I represent all the 11 cities in Marin County on the Bridge District, which is a big appointment. That was the time when the council with me, Jager, Laura Fratzker, Joan Bosnicker, and Doug Vindrup. And so I announced I'm going to run for the seat on the Bridge Board. the mayor's and councilman meeting, only Jaeger showed up to support me. Prasker may have, she was just flaky and she just didn't show up a lot at these meetings. But Bosnecker and Binderup, they were not happy. But to vote against me would have been basically, would have started a war on Mill Valley. So they couldn't do that, so they just kind of had no comment. Fortunately, I had extremely good relationships with the council members in most of the other cities. And so I run against a guy from Cordenware, Dunn's, Jim Dunn. He later became very helpful to me. They call the roll. There had been an error in those days, the mayors and councilmen, typical. They print the letterhead up, and they forget one town. There's 10 names on the letterhead. It's always the same town they forget. And they're so paranoid, it's crazy. Novato.
Oh.
Novato's not on the letterhead. So that night, the big vote comes up. We've been working it for a month, trying to get all the towns lined up. You vote by delegation, you know. If one guy shows up, you cast the vote. If all five shows up, you got to take a vote among yourselves, you know. So they call a roll, and I have five votes. Dunn has four votes. One town is tied. Fairfax, 2-2. It's a pass. But you got to get six votes to win. I have five. Dunn has four. One ties. And for a second, they said, that's it. That's the thing. We're going to need a runoff. And for a moment, there's all the buzz in the room. And somebody else, we forgot Novato. Oh, shit. They got to call Novato. They're just sitting there. One guy, Hugh Turner, sitting there by himself. And he sits next to a friend of mine who's a councilman from Belvedere, chairman of the Republican Central Committee, named Dick Bozell. And he turns to Bozell and says, I don't know either of these people. What should I do? Bozell says, vote for sponsor. And Turner says, Novato votes for sponsor. Hmm. And that's six votes. Ran the gamble.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that was a big deal. And I wasn't so much anxious about worried about getting off city councils. But I didn't want to leave the Bridge District. The two-term tradition, there was a tradition. It probably wasn't as hard as it is now, but there was a tradition. So what I did basically was call everybody I knew in Mill Valley that I thought could object. And I said, what do you think? Starting with Gene Barnard. And they said, go for it. We'll support you. And so I said, well, I'm going to do it. And I did. And there wasn't any opposition. Nobody raised the issue. It just wasn't because I talked to everybody who could have.
Yeah.
And so I did after, but they made it clear. Three's the limit. And so that's what happened.
Yeah. Now in 1980, when you were first elected, Mill Valley was kind of a different town then.
Oh yeah.
What was the big issue?
Development.
Development?
Sure. And there was, God, if you remember her name, it was a planning commissioner. She was down there on by Camino Alto. You'll know her. Helen. And she was close to Bosnecker.
Helen.
Oh, I can't remember her name now. It'll come to me. And she, there was Weiss, who was on the planning commission. John Weiss, who was planning commission, was an architect. They were really, it was a little bit of the Burton days. They were very much open to much more development in Mill Valley. And I was not, and I think it's fair to say that the folks supporting me were not. And the feeling was that the city manager, Vern Hazen, was supportive of more development. And that whole bridge over Sycamore Avenue, bridge over the bay was a big issue.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of, you talked about a lot of issues in the campaign, but if there was a division in the community, that was probably the last gasp until planned Miller Avenue, precise plan, the last gasp when there was any real pro-development feelings in Mill Valley. And when I won, and Kathleen Foote won, and the other guys were kind of in retreat, that stopped. And it became not acceptable. And Dawson became the city manager. He understood that the majority was opposed to it. And even Hazen, when he was city manager, I remember I came in and I talked to him one time when I was right elected, and he said, we got to work together to stop this thing. And I said, Vernon, I thought you were for that. He says, I'm for whatever the majority of the council wants. That's the city manager's job. I said, wow, well, damn.
That's good.
Yeah. Wow. We had a very good group. It was a little strained there for a while with Bo Snicker and Vinderup. I will say that when I ran for the third term, and I'm sure you remember this, Bo Snicker, I was trying to show we had everybody could get along. And as you may recall, you and Joan weren't that close.
No.
And I'd ask you and her to be my co-chairman. And everybody says, I don't know if they're speaking to each other. I said, that's the last thing I'm worried about. It was symbolic that this could happen. And she said yes. I'm not sure she did much, but it was a good sign that the divisions were going away. And I think that for a while there were, and I think, well, less so now, but there was certainly a period when Dawson was city manager that there really was a feeling of cohesion in town. There was not a divergence of opinions as to directions of the community. And we did have excellent city management.
Yeah.
And the council brings the city management.
Yeah. Vern Hazen was good and Dawson was good.
Well, no, Vern Hazen was good. Dawson was excellent. Vern Hazen was good and Dawson was excellent.
Yeah.
And we're back to good again.
Yeah. Good. Good. Okay. Well, that brings us to the present day.
It does. I was very blessed when I left the city council. I wanted to stay active. One way I did it was join Rotary. I thought that would bring me into town because I was still commuting to work in the city.
Right.
And the other thing was I was very blessed that I'd been on the advisory board for KRCB television. I suggested to them that they start doing election night programming.
Right.
And they said, let's do it.
Right.
And we made that happen. This will be our 22nd year we just finished, I guess.
You've kept your finger in Marin politics with your column.
Well, I was blessed. Paul Anderson, as you know, owned the Scope. His daughter, Jill Anderson, was in the same class as my daughter at St. Patrick's. And they knew each other very well. And so I was having dinner with him one night at the Chamber of Commerce. And I said, you know, you ought to have me write a column. And he said, send me four column samples. I sent him four. He said, I like three of the four. And let's do it. I said, what's the one you didn't like? He says, it was on two big-time politics. And he says, we can buy those easy. Any newspaper can. What I want is local. And so the other three were all local. So I'd like you to do a local column. I said, it has to be in all the Scope papers. I don't want to just write for the Milwaukee Herald. He said, no, that'll be the deal. Every Scope paper. And then, for various reasons, I started writing for the Novato Advance, which was a separate column, because J.J. Jackson was the editor there, and he says, I want to convince them we live in Marin County. And then somebody was at the IJ who had to bet the Advance after JJ left and went to the IJ. And after a couple of months, I went up to him and said, are you interested in restarting there? And I just got a scoop on them on something. And they said yes, bottom line.
Yeah.
So that's been...
That was when I joined the Scope as the executive editor.
Yeah, I have now written 535 Sundays for the IJ because they're numbered. And then a year and a half ago, I started going twice a week.
Yeah, that's right.
On Wednesdays.
Yeah.
So people always say to me, do you miss politics? And I think to myself, what are they talking about?
You're not out of it.
I know.
Yeah.
I know. But people say that all the time.
Yeah. And now your best fans are the Bicycle Coalition.
They love me. They love me. I had lunch with the editor of the IJ for Christmas.
For the record, we're saying this with our tongue in our cheek.
Yes. The head editor of the IJ says, is there anything you want me to do different? And he says, nothing. Do what you're doing. Perfect. You're getting more hits on the website than anybody else. And, as you know, all they care about is readership. They want people to read it.
Yeah.
And if people read it, you can say whatever you want. I've never been censored.
That's good.
And I can say I was never censored at the Scope. I was never censored at the IJ. And there was one controversial column I wrote before an election day in Novato, which for some reason, due to a glitch, didn't make it in the paper.
Oh.
And I regard that as questionable.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else you think we missed?
I still love Mill Valley.
Absolutely.
And fabulous. When I write about something in the paper, I fundamentally ask myself two questions. How's this going to impact Mill Valley? And second, what would I have done when I criticize somebody if I was the elected official in their place? Because I think that's fair. Because you ought to have your own answer. Not it's bad isn't good enough.
Right.
It's bad, and here's what we should do instead is necessary.
Right. How is Mill Valley different from when you first came here?
I went to the police department 2 weeks ago, talked to a man who'd been there a long time. I'm doing a thing on cameras, on police body cameras and car cameras. And I said, he was talking about the old days. He said, well, it's changed a lot. And basically what he was saying was that you have a new group of people in town who feel very entitled. And they're wealthier people, better educated, not very grounded in local stuff, sometimes younger, and are very demanding. And they don't see it as a two-way street where you give back to the community. They're just demanding. They spend a lot of money for a house, and they want it. They want everything done their way. And that's a difficult situation. We didn't have that. I think we had more of a communal feeling, and it was a more of a mixed, broader town with rich, I don't want to say poor, but working-class people, middle-class people, wealthy people who felt a commitment to the community. People like Dick Jessup, who didn't flaunt money. And went to Princeton, was an Olympian. But you didn't know it. Drove a kind of battered up car. And that's missed.
Yeah.
And so that's that. As you become more wealthy, you lose that.
Yeah.
And it's a very attractive place. It's understandable from supply and demand. It's just a factor of change.
Yeah. Gene Barnard used to say the biggest enemy that Mill Valley has is the automobile.
Well, that's true. But what are you going to do? I always saw Mill Valley, the best description I used, to understand the politics of Mill Valley, it's a New England college town without the college. A lot of professors and people who think that way. They're very open. It's New England because they tend to be frugal. They don't mind spending public money, but they want to spend properly. They don't want to spend foolishly. So we're willing to have a library, but you better do it. You better be tough on when you're doing your budgeting. We want to have good parks. Let's not get crazy. They want the service, but they're not like San Francisco. A lot of places don't want it. No government. We're against government. San Francisco, spend all you can spend. The more money, the better. The Mill Valley guys are in between. They want the service, but they're pretty frugal when it comes to the money.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you, Dick.
Pleasure.